Well, I think that's really telling of your character. I mean, you've retired 22 years ago and you still come in to work on your frogs. And so what does keep you coming back to work on these frogs?
Well, there's still things I don't know. And there's still interesting questions to ask.
Blue Dot, Episode 25, The Brain Scoop's Emily Grassley and How Gravity is Unlocking the Secrets of the San Andreas Fault.
This is Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom.
And I'm Nolan Ford.
Well, Nolan, it's another episode, and it's time for a new feature.
That's right. What's that?
Now it's time for Science on the Tube. A semi-regular, in other words, whenever we feel like it, look at science content being presented in a cool and engaging way on video, as opposed to the far more fabulous thing we call radio. So today we have Blue Dot Special Assignment reporter Sarah Bohannon. She interviewed one of my favorite stars of YouTube.
And who's that?
Emily Grassley. She's the host of a channel called The Brain Scoop. And she is a person that works out of the Field Museum in Chicago. It's one of the world's largest natural history museums. It's got these just amazing collections. Huge staff of scientists. And she's just an amazing person. And, you know, the Field Museum is where Sue, the T-Rex, is the world's largest intact T-Rex skeleton. So every day when she goes to work, she gets greeted by a Tyrannosaurus Rex. How many people can say that?
Not too many.
That's pretty cool. So let's listen to Sarah's interview.
This is Blue Dot, and I'm Sarah Bohannon. My guest is Emily Grassley, the chief curiosity correspondent for the Field Museum of Chicago. She's also a YouTube star of the popular channel The Brain Scoop, which deals with her work as an outreach educator at the field. It's one of the world's most prestigious natural history museums and is famously home to Sue, the Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton. Welcome, Emily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Emily, what exactly is a chief curiosity correspondent, and are you the only one at the field with that job title?
Yeah, actually, I happen to be the only one in the world with that job title so far. It's a nice icebreaker, I suppose, for just talking about my role as a digital outreach, informal educator, and professional enthusiast for natural history museums.
When did you first get interested in natural history and specifically the study of dead specimens?
It's hard for me to say. I think growing up, I always loved animals. I always loved the outdoors and wildlife, but I never really saw how that would translate into a job in natural history. I don't even think I knew what natural history as like a science or a discipline or a focus even was. I grew up in South Dakota, so it's not like we had a ton of museums. We did have a couple smaller institutions, but nothing to like the scope of like the Field Museum in Chicago. And so I ended up studying art in college and became really interested in nature through landscape painting, and eventually found my way to our campus Natural History Museum, which had no public displays. It only had research specimens. And so from that moment, I just became enamored with the idea of studying wildlife specifically through their remains. Because, I mean, to me, I had never really, you know, it's one thing to learn about wolves or something. It's another thing to be holding the skull of an individual in your hands and feel this connection with nature that I had never experienced before.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Sarah Bohannon, and I'm talking to Emily Grassley, chief curiosity correspondent at the Field Museum in Chicago and YouTube star on the popular channel The Brain Scoop. I've noticed that your videos are getting even more diverse. I really like the panda and the flapper and the one where you had scientists tell how they'd classify candies.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about some of your favorite recent uploads?
Yeah, I'd say those two are pretty far up there. I'm a big fan of the candy taxonomy video, especially because normally when I'm working with research scientists at the museum, there's a lot of preparation involved. It's what I do here is a collaborative effort. It's not just me kind of cherry picking things that I want to talk about or things that I'm interested, but helping scientists identify the narrative in their own work and helping them bring that narrative to life. So in the preparation of a lot of our other videos, there's a lot of back and forth and a lot of planning meetings and a lot of like me reading their papers. And for that one, I was like, you know, we did this video called What is a Species, which might have been like the most research-intensive video I've ever done on the channel. I mean, it's just the biological species concepts. Like, there is no one definition of what a species is. Scientists have all these different tools and ways to interpret what a species is, depending on if you're an entomologist or a paleontologist or whatever. And so, you know, the video was pretty dense, and I wanted to talk about the similar themes, but in a way that was more accessible. So what I did was I just emailed these four research scientists and asked them if they'd be available to come down for 15 minutes on a shoot day, and I wanted them to categorize something. So they didn't really know what they were getting themselves into. And when they showed up, it's exactly as I kind of imagined. All these four different scientists with these four different disciplines had four completely different ways of interpreting this information. And so that was a lot of fun. I'm pretty excited about this video we did. It's called A Lifetime of Curiosity. We published it a few weeks ago. But this encapsulates why I do the Brain Scoop and why I'm so excited about working in a museum. There's a herpetologist, a amphibian reptile expert at the museum named Dr. Inger, and he started in the museum in 1949, I want to say. He retired in 1994, so he's 96 years old, and he retired 22 years ago, and he continues to come into the museum to work on a revised manuscript about the frogs of Borneo, an area where he worked for 60 years. And normally, you know, with an interview, we'll sit down and chat for 30 minutes or whatever. And for this interview, we just let the cameras run. You know, I think we talked for close to an hour and a half with Dr. Inger, because how do you summarize 70 years of scientific research in a 7-minute video? We just weren't sure of how it would happen. So there's a ton that got caught out of the interview, but I think my favorite part of the whole thing, and what still kind of I get a little emotional about, is the very last question when I asked him, you know, why continue coming in? Why, what keeps him motivated to keep working on his manuscripts? And he looked at me like I was stupid. And then he was kind of like, well, like the answer was obvious. You know, he was like, well, there's stuff I still don't know and questions I still have to ask. And I think that just encapsulates so well, my passion for this and my passion for being a lifetime learner. Like, you can be asking questions up until you're 96 years old and admitting you still have things you want to learn, I think is really inspiring.
So I especially like the Ask Emily episodes. Can you tell us a little bit more about those?
Yeah. We started doing Ask Emily videos right at the beginning, because I think, you know, in order for us to create a really strong community, the viewers of our channel have to be able to participate. You know, you have to give them some way that they can be involved. And so I really love our Ask Emily videos. It's a great opportunity for me to learn what our viewers are interested in learning more about and things that they're curious about. And I'm really excited because we used to just take questions on social media. And we recently set up a Google Voice account with a hotline. So if you've got a question, you can actually call into a hotline and leave a message on our voicemail. And so that's been a whole new level of bringing people into our videos. And we can use their actual voice recordings and questions in our upcoming Ask Emily videos. So that's been a lot of fun.
This is Blue Dot. I'm Sarah Bohannon, and I'm talking to Emily Grassley. Let's talk about your work at the Field Museum. Tell us a bit about what it's like to work at such a huge, iconic museum.
It can be a little overwhelming at times, just in terms of the fact that there is so much going on every single day here. There are so many things that happen behind closed doors at the museum, not because they're meant to be kept away from the public, just because, you know, we live where we work behind closed doors. But getting the opportunity to kind of have a front row seat to a lot of these discoveries and to be able to interface with scientists who are unquestionably experts in their field and sometimes world leaders in the positions that they have, it's just a really humbling position to be in. I never imagined that I'd get the chance to talk to people who are naming and describing new species to science, or people who are making brand new discoveries about our planet that we never before knew. I mean, it's just something a position I never could have even dreamed of being in. So even though I've been here for 3 years, I still get so excited to come into work because there's always something new to learn and there's something new that people are discovering. And I just love that I get to be a part of it.
Why do you think science and education channels have become so important on YouTube?
Well, YouTube is this really phenomenal resource. It's replaced or started to sort of replace traditional, YouTube is a new avenue for people to access information and education in a way that wasn't as accessible before. You know, when I was growing up, you could turn on PBS, but it was always kind of a gamble what was going to be on or if it would be a show I'd be interested in. But YouTube has this wonderful ability to allow the user to pick what they're interested in and for them to, like, go down these rabbit holes of education. And I think that's really great. And also what YouTube has done, it's, like, democratized informal education. So when I was growing up, I had no idea how somebody became a TV star. You know, I didn't know what the process was for, if you have an idea for a TV show, to pitch it to executives who then you'd maybe go through a trial period, you'd get a little bit of funding to create a pilot, and then it would go to a group of viewers or an audience, a select audience who would rate if they would watch it. You know, it's just like this whole long process, and maybe it would take years at a time. But now if we have an idea for a video, we can film it the next day, and it can be on YouTube in a week. And I just think that level of spontaneity lends itself so well to science discoveries. And we're now able to tell people nearly in real time when discoveries are happening. And I think that can be really inspirational for people who might think that, you know, everything's been done, we know everything about the world, there are no more questions to ask. So to demonstrate that the world of science is constantly evolving and changing and being shaped and shaping the world around us constantly, I think is one of the best things that YouTube lends to informal educators.
So what's next for Emily Grassley?
That's a great question. I'm actually super excited. We've spent the last, like, 4 months building 2 production sets in the museum. One of the biggest challenges of working in the field museum, and it's understandable, is that we have no, like, set film space. You know, who would have thought that when they built the field museum in 1923, they didn't account for a couple of production studios? So it's kind of been a challenge to find a lab space or a workspace or a collection where we can suitably film and consistently. You know, it can take us hours to set up our lights, and sometimes the rooms don't have outlets, or there's a weird fan noise, or there are visiting researchers, and we don't want to interrupt them. So a couple months ago, we moved into a few unused offices, and we built 2 production sets, and that's going to allow us to be able to create weekly content, which is something that has been on a goal of mine for, like, the last 2 years. We've been uploading videos every other Wednesday, and hopefully in the next 2 months or so, we'll be making weekly content. So I'm really excited about that.
Thank you so much, Emily.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Emily Grassley, Chief Curiosity Correspondent for the Field Museum in Chicago. You can follow Emily on Twitter at M-E, that's at E-H-M-E-E, and check out her YouTube channel, The Brain Scoop. I'm Sarah Bohannon, and you're listening to Blue Dot on NSPR.
Sarah Bohannon and her interview with Emily Grassley. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, Emily's a great interviewee, and she speaks very intelligently about the work that she does with Brain Scoop.
She's a very talented, multidimensional young person, and she does a lot of interesting things on YouTube. Once in a while, she appears on the Hank Green channel, SciShow, or she used to anyway, and I've seen her on a channel called How to Adult. There's an episode there that she did a few years ago, and I love it. She shows you how to make really good chocolate chip cookies. There's even a video of her teaching you how to braid your hair the way she does. And I tried it, but it just didn't work out for me.
Yeah, I still need to learn how to do that too.
Well, yeah, I'm follically challenged, so.
Someday we'll learn how to adult.
Maybe if I got little nanobots, they could braid my hair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We can work on that in a future episode.
No, that'd be a good idea. When we come back, we will talk to Nicholas Vander Elst. He's a scientist that's come up with an amazing study about the relationship between tidal forces from the sun and the moon and the earth and the San Andreas Fault. That's coming up next on Blue Dot. And we're back, and you are listening to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom, and we're talking to our next guest, Nicholas Vander Elst. He's the lead author of a new paper that correlates the effect of tidal forces between the Earth, Moon, and Sun system in deep earthquakes on the San Andreas Fault. Nicholas, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you.
Could you start by briefly giving us a tidal forces 101? What causes these forces, and how can they affect the Earth beyond the obvious effects on the ocean?
Sure. So the tides are caused by the gravitational pull of the sun and the moon. The same way that the Earth's gravity holds the moon in orbit, the moon has its own gravity, which pulls back on the Earth. And so this produces the ocean tides that we're very familiar with, where the oceans bulge up in the direction of the moon, and that tidal bulge sloshes around at the seashore. Well, the same effect happens in the solid rock of the Earth. The effect is a little less dramatic, but the solid crust of the Earth actually bulges out in the direction of the moon. This flexes the crust, and it transmits stresses to the faults that are within that crust.
Let's get one thing straight right off the top. Your study is not claiming a correlation between large earthquakes and tidal forces, right?
Correct. So our study looked at a fairly special kind of earthquake, which we call a low-frequency earthquake, or sometimes tremor, and these are subtle, almost imperceptible signals coming from deep on the fault. Down at 20 to 30 kilometers depth, the part of the faults that actually produce the big damaging earthquakes only goes down to 10 or 15 kilometers. So this is a signal that's coming from below the places on the fault that would actually produce large earthquakes.
Now, we've observed these tidal forces on the fault before, right?
Yeah, so the daily correlation between low-frequency earthquakes or tremor has been observed correlating with the daily tide in a number of places, including the San Andreas here where we're looking, and also the Cascadia subduction zone off of Oregon and Washington, and other places in Japan. So this is just the first study to go back and look at how that tidal triggering varies over the fortnightly cycle.
Okay, let's talk about that and what your study has found, which is unique. You correlate these low-frequency earthquakes, tremors that are down deep, with a fortnightly diurnal cycle. Let's start with kind of a glossary of terms.
Yeah.
What exactly is a low-frequency earthquake?
Right. So a low-frequency earthquake, it sounds like we might be saying they're infrequent, but actually the term low-frequency relates to how they sound seismologically. So you can think of these as having more of a low rumbling sound compared to ordinary big crustal earthquakes. And they originate from deep on the fault, where it's kind of going through a transition from brittle stick slip earthquake behavior to more ductile plastic, you know, flowing rock behavior at depth.
I know that diurnal refers to the day-night cycle, and fortnight is 2 weeks. How does this all fit together?
The daily tidal cycle is the one that we're most familiar with. Off of California, we've got a double cycle with two highs, two lows every day. And then the fortnightly cycle is the longer two-week cycle where the moon is going from a new moon to a full moon and then back to a new moon over the course of a month. But that 2 weeks between new moon and full moon controls the relative amplitude of the daily tide. So when the moon and the sun are aligned, you get big tides. When they're at 90 degrees from each other, you get subdued tides. So we're looking at that two-week variation in the strength of the tides and how that affects the fault.
How can these findings help us further our understanding of the San Andreas Fault? And are there implications for forecasting maybe heightened periods of earthquake danger from this?
So scientifically, these LFEs and the fact that they respond to this tidal triggering is a real bonanza. Because prior to this, you know, these signals existed, but we hadn't noticed them. We weren't good at detecting them. So we really had no idea what was going on the fault at these depths. So being able to detect these LFEs really opens up a window into a part of the fault that we haven't been able to observe before. And one of the surprising things is that the fault really does continue down into the Earth past the part where it's producing earthquakes. You can see these tremors localized on a fault even at 20 miles down. And the other really amazing thing that surprised everyone, I think, was how weak the fault appears to be. So the fact that it responds to the tides at all, you know, the forces involved in the lunar tide are, they're large when you add them up, but if you think of just a 1 meter square section of the fault, the tidal contribution is not much bigger than what you could deliver to the fault by pushing on it. So the stresses are just tiny. So the fact that the fault responds at all means that the fault has to be really extraordinarily weak, which is not something we would have expected given that there's 20 miles of rock sitting on top of it.
You mentioned that we had not really noticed this before. Is this because of some new methodology in looking at the data or some new instrumentation that's allowing us to probe deeper? How?
I think the real revolution was the switch from using seismometers that had a triggered recording mode where they only recorded if they sensed a big earthquake to one where they record data continuously and you can go back and look at that data retrospectively. So we only noticed these signals when we started looking at lots of continuously recorded seismograms together. And then you notice this signal, which is, it barely comes out of the noise. These are smaller than magnitude 1 earthquakes. So it's only really when you look at a bunch of signals and you add them up that you can really notice this activity.
Another thing that I understand from this is it really does help us understand what's happening with the plate motions at depth, right?
Yeah, so this is, it's like a creep meter or a speedometer for that plate motion. The plate tectonics machine is running down at 20 miles down on these faults. So even though they look pretty inactive at the surface, you can actually see these LFEs, this tremor is like the grinding noise showing that these faults are continuously displacing and accumulating slip at depth.
The San Andreas Fault is locked in places, and it's creeping along steadily in others. For example, the southern part of the fault adjacent to L.A. has been described as locked and loaded. Did your study see any correlations along lines with the fault, with those types of motions?
Yeah. Well, so the whole reason that we see these LFEs right where they are is because there's a special seismic observatory there around the town of Parkfield, which is right at this transition from the part where the fault is creeping to the part where it's, as you say, locked and loaded, the part that Angelinos typically associate with the big one. So this is right at that northern end of the locked section where the fault transitions from this one behavior to the other. And that makes it really interesting. We'd love to understand why faults in some situations slide steadily and why they slide in earthquakes in other places.
I can remember hearing stuff about the lunar cycle having effects on earthquakes on like late night talk show radio, with people that I would not describe as real scientists. But have there ever really been truly scientific attempts to correlate these with what's going on the San Andreas Fault? And if so, how did you draw on that work?
Yeah, absolutely. So there have definitely been studies that have been scientific about it. It's often easy to find an earthquake that happens, during a full moon, during an eclipse, during, something that seems portentous. But to do it scientifically, you have to go look at every earthquake and every lunar cycle and make sure that the signal holds up. And so when people have done this, historically, they weren't really able to see any tidal response. As we get more data and as the studies get more sophisticated, people have gone to special locations on the Earth where the faults are particularly shallow or well-oriented so that the tide is really pulling in the direction that the fault wants to slip. And there they actually do see tiny amounts of encouragement when you have the high tides. So we're talking just less than a percent change in the earthquake rate. But if you look over a long enough time period, you can actually start to see that the signal is there. It's subtle. It's way too small to be useful for predicting earthquakes. But if you look closely enough, you do actually see some of that, the effect of the Earth being squeezed and compressed by the tidal cycle.
You're listening to Blue Dot, and we are talking to Nicholas van der Elst. He is a scientist at the United States Geological Survey's Earthquake Science Center. And we're talking about tidal forces on the San Andreas Fault. Why do you think this is important for like your average Californian that lives within range of the San Andreas Fault?
Well, so this is You know, we've had this observation for about 10 years, and it's still a really hot topic of study. This is only the latest in a series of papers that have come out on this particular section of the San Andreas and similar sections elsewhere. Whenever we have a new window into new sources of information, new discoveries follow. So this is one of those advances that, studying this tremor in general is one of those advances that I think will lead to fundamental improvements in our understanding of the earthquake cycle. In terms of what you should take away from this on a, you know, today, is just that the plate tectonics engine is running. You can see the fault moving at depth. Eventually, that shallow fault has to catch up with the motion at depth. So this should be a reminder to Californians that this is earthquake country, and in the absence of being able to predict earthquakes, your only option is really preparedness.
Did you find similar correlations, or can we apply this to other places? Like, for example, you mentioned Cascadia, the region between Northern California and British Columbia.
Yeah, that's the other place where seismologists really have their ear to the ground listening to this deep tremor, in the hopes that, you know, when we have many years of observations, we might see changes in that tremor rate or the behavior of these low-frequency earthquakes that might tell us something about an earthquake becoming more likely. But in general, this is, you know, the most important thing about these earthquakes is that they open up a window into the workings of the deep fault that just wouldn't be available otherwise.
It almost seems analogous to me about the detection of gravitational waves as a new way of probing what's going on with, you know, with things that are happening far away with black holes and things like that.
That's a good analogy in the sense that it's another case where you have a very small signal. It's smaller than the noise, so your exercise ends up being one of trying to reduce the noise as much as possible, and you have to use your intuition to guide how you look for that signal. And then if you can really control the noise sources and amplify the signal, that's the way to push forward discovery in this sort of age of signal processing and big data.
Nicholas, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's Nicholas Vander Elst. He's a geophysicist at the Earthquake Science Center for the United States Geological Survey in Pasadena. Well, Nolan, we had an interesting show today. We had Nicholas Vander Elst talking about the deep workings of the San Andreas Fault, probing the mysteries down there 20, 30, 40 miles below the crust. And, of course, our wonderful interview with Sarah Bohannon and Emily Grassley. What a fun show.
Yeah, it was a great time just learning so much about these great scientists.
It was. Well, until next time, Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Shlom. And I'm reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.